Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Live from Capitol. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun, the podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson, your host. Forget the adjectives. No, I'm just the host. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. If you haven't been with us, welcome. If you're a regular listener, thanks so much. Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we look back over the mountaintops from whence we came. Some we've conquered. Others, mountains in our past sent us careening down rocky escarpments of our own selfishness, and other mountains sending us over the cliffs of heartbreak and betrayal. This one's good for a soap opera, huh? But hey, we look back on that tableau with forgiveness for the wounds, gratitude for the lessons, and we turn our heads toward tomorrow. And tomorrow's mountaintops will figure out their own ways to kick our butts, as we all know. But here we are with another episode of Big Pop Fun, brought to you by art. Please go support artists. It's springtime. There are art shows in your town. There are plays in your town. Go and support. Hey, support the arts by buying art. Or get involved in some way. Let's do this and not just accept, you know, plastic extrusions from machines as everything that we care about owning. Own something that either went into your mind or went into your hands as a craft, as a piece of art, as a painting that someone made. Also, it's brought to you by my book, The Masked Man, for Nook and Kindle and iPad. It's out there. Please read it. I hope you enjoy it. A lot of people have so far. So thanks. Those are my two commercials, besides myself, who goes around and does little shows where they have grown-up drinks and chicken wings, and we have a lot of fun. And I'm going to a lot of places, and I don't have a list because I'm so professional. I don't have a list of where I'm going, but I'm going to Denver, and I'm going to Orlando, and I'm going to a lot of cities. So come out and see me, and please say that you tell me you listen to the podcast. Thank you, Jen in Philadelphia. Yes, you, Jen, who sent me the postcard with stickers on it, with like glittery smiley stickers, saying that you love the podcast and you listen to it with your stickers and butterflies. Jen, it's not a postcard of Philadelphia. It's a postcard from Niagara Falls. So Jen went out to her local Wawa, got herself a hoagie, and drove up to like Buffalo, New York, or where they got, you know, Niagara Falls. That's up in upstate New York, where us Philadelphians go if we want to go to like Montreal or Buffalo, or where they got, you know, they got cities up there, whatever. Canada, I don't know, whatever they got. And we go and we bring our stuff. We bring our pretzel sticks and some couple cheesesteaks, and we have a good time. So Jen from – all right, I'm stopping. That's all right. But Niagara Falls, it's a beautiful postcard. And I thank Jen for the postcard of the rainbow across Niagara Falls, which is a great destination itself. I've performed at Buffalo many times, always loved it. Niagara Falls is one of those wonders of the world that I've been very, very fortunate to see so many wonders of the world in my adventurous life. And Niagara Falls is certainly one of them. But going to Buffalo, I thought, maybe see Niagara Falls. It's probably, you know, it's probably big falls or whatever. I've seen it on TV. It looks big and impressive. Niagara Falls will blow you away, just the size and scope of the whole thing. If you ever get a chance and you're up that way, definitely go and see Niagara Falls and go to the Hurricane Deck, as my friend Paul took me to, the Hurricane Deck, where you take off, I guess, most of your clothes, and you put on their clothes. You put on slickers and things, and even shoes. You put on these galoshes, and you go to a wooden deck that they've built right next to the falls, just close enough to begin to feel the massive power of the rushing water, which is beyond description, but it really is quite an experience. So if you ever end up in Niagara Falls, go to that Hurricane Deck and tell them Tom and Paul sent you. It was cold. It was cold that day. We saw steam from our mouths. I'm sure you do that a lot in Buffalo, but in California, like this morning, it's April, and there was still this morning driving to school there. There was, we could see our breath still in April. And in LA, okay, that's a rare thing. So everyone does that. Just like the first day of fall when you start doing it and all the kids are going, I can see my breath. Well, even adults do that in California because it's pretty rare. So I did it this morning and because it was cold. You know, I was in a movie once in Mexico. It was in the jungle, and the movie, they had scenes that were to be shot in Chicago and in the jungle in Mexico, but they were trying to figure out a way to save money and shoot the scenes that we had to do in Chicago in a barn and in Illinois and shoot them in Mexico. The problem was, it was going to be midwinter in Chicago, and you couldn't see our breath. It was Mexico, where they never see their breath in Mexico. It's that cold in the mountains, but you never do. So that was the big problem. The director was talking to people. How can we do this in Mexico? They literally went and investigated shooting the scene in a giant freezer. They were looking for, what, can we do it in a refrigerated truck? Is there like a meat locker somewhere where we can have the guys and we can build the walls that would look like a barn, but it would actually be a freezer in Mexico? And then we could see our breath. Well, there were no freezers big enough in order to fit all of the guys in the scene and the props and build the walls as if the walls of the barn. It would be clear that this was a barn that was like 8 feet by 8 feet. So it was just that was thrown out. The special effects man on the movie had an idea. Now, special effects people, they're in charge of everything that blows up, everything that does something special. If you have a coffee pot that has to tip over after I say time for coffee, and then somehow someone left it at the edge of a table and it tips over, but it has to tip over right at that point, they're the people who figure out, how do we tip over a coffee pot right there? Will it be a wire? Will it be a little thing under the coffee pot with a button that we just push and it tips it over? That's special effects. They do that from those tiny kinds of things all the way until blowing up the building and Mel Gibson and Danny Glover are running from the building and the entire building is demolished. They do that too. They do all that stuff. They've done stuff. I've actually run away from a blowing up thing, and it's, well, I'll tell that another time, but that's quite an experience. Special effects does that, where the big gigantic thing blows up as you're running away from it. Anyway, the special effects man on this movie I was doing gets an idea. He says, I'm going to fix this. We are going to shoot this in Mexico. I'm going to save the company a lot of money. The director will be thrilled with me. I will work for the rest of my life and everyone will be happy. He goes away for days. I've got the plan, he says. I've got the plan. He comes back. He says, here's how we're going to do it. Can I talk to the actors? A few of the actors, myself included, who was going to be in the scene, go over to him along with the director. He shows us, well, first of all, he's staring at us. Then he goes into his mouth and he takes out a small piece of plastic. It looks, is that a retainer? Is it some kind of braces thing? What does he have? He brings it out of his mouth. Fitted to his upper palate, you know, the top of his mouth between his upper teeth, fitted. He's formed a piece of plastic. The plastic fits to his mouth perfectly, but there's a pocket inside of it where, with another piece of plastic below. And that piece of plastic, the one that will hit your tongue, has holes in it. He says, this is the answer. He shows us. It's this piece of plastic. We said, what are you going to do? He says, I'm going to put dry ice in the little pocket in this plastic, and then you put it in your mouth and you speak. And the steam that comes out of the dry ice will always be coming out of your mouth. So, of course, we stare at him for a good 6 to 8 seconds saying, well, we're not doing that. I mean, what are you talking about? And he's done a lot of work on this thing. He's worked hard. And what are you going to do? No, this is going to do it. Look, wait. So everyone's saying, well, it will burn. Doesn't dry ice burn? It's not supposed to be against your skin, is it? No, I've built the plastic that way. It will protect your upper palate. It's a thin layer of plastic. So you could just put dry ice up against the roof of your mouth. No problem at all. So we say, well, let's see how it works. So he puts these chips of dry ice. Yeah, let's see you do it. He puts the chips of dry ice in the little pocket in the plastic piece, and it is steaming because that's what happens to dry ice, as we know, when it is in contact with air. And he says, look at this, it's perfect. He puts it in his mouth and literally says, you see, it works perfectly. I can do this all day long. It's just and then it's like, and then he takes it out of his mouth because it's freezing the roof of his mouth and burning his mouth. And he took it there without having it. So that didn't work out. And we went to Chicago, and it cost them more money because we had to find a barn somewhere in Illinois and do the scene. And believe me, you can see the steam coming out of our mouths because it was 10 below zero. So there. Speaking of special effects, you know what? The show that I was in that never had any special effects was Freaks and Geeks, which is a very popular show now, as I've talked about on the podcast. And it's a huge hit show as a DVD because really very few people watched it when it was on television. And now it's got quite a cult following as a DVD set. So Freaks and Geeks did not have special effects. The only special effect that was amazing about the show was its portrayal of authentic humanity. And if you're anything like me, that's so rare to see on a television show or a movie that should actually be a special effect now, just the portrayal of authentic humanity and the way people live. But it certainly was. And Martin Starr was one of the actors, one of the stars, really, of Freaks and Geeks. Martin was a young guy when I met him on the show. And we talk about it in our conversation, so I won't over – I've already over-introduced, as is my wont to do. But I was struck with Martin as a very young man, with his relaxation before the camera, his improvisational skills, and his ability very early in his life to – as an actor, to portray an authentic human being. With flaws and with fears, as a kid, I was really moved by his performance in many of the episodes. Anyway, hey, enjoy my conversation with Martin Starr.
Big Pop Fun.
Were your parents in the business
in Sherman Oaks? My mom. Was and always will be an actress. My dad was a salesman and became a teacher in Florida. Now he teaches in Florida, but he got his degree and everything out here and then moved to Florida for the love of his life.
Who was a different person?
Who was his third wife.
Oh, okay.
And I think he finally figured out how to love. It's interesting. It was interesting to watch a man at 50, like, figure. I think it was a great example set.
What do you
for me?
I think that's great. But what in seeing that happen? What do you mean? What was the evidence that you saw in Dad, if I may? And believe me. We don't have to talk about the, you know, we
no,
can talk
I'm,
about.
No, I'm open to talking about anything because he's been one of my best guidances in life and he's made a big impact in my world. I'm happy to talk about it. He just kind of – my parents became Buddhist a year before I was born. Some guy was going door-to-door and they got –
It was a little bit like door-to-door Buddhism, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just proselytization all over the country, really. But specifically in Los Angeles, they were hitting it pretty hard. So they became Buddhist out here. And then, and that delved my father into his own life and trying to evolve his like well-being as a human and the way that he lived his life. And that led to, eventually, I think, him figuring out that he didn't want to be with my mom. And then figuring out the kind of human he wanted to be in a relationship that he knew was healthy and the kind of relationship that he wanted fundamentally, but didn't know how to create. And I think now he's still figuring out how to be a good husband and father and man. But he's made a lot of mistakes along the way.
Yeah. Did he, I mean, he married another person after your mom? Or
he married my mom, whose name is Jean, and then married my... We're really breaking it out. Then he married my mom's brother's ex-wife, also named Jean.
Huh. But that wasn't... He was still in search of something that you could see. That he's coming to, he's where he's bringing it together now.
I think he's always like, I feel like if you're not in search of something, if you're not, and I don't mean in like a lost kind of sense, but if you're not seeking to achieve something in your life, you might as well be dead. Like there's no, like if you're not struggling to create something, like, you know, what's the point? I mean, maybe that's a depressed outlook, but I feel
I don't think it's a depressed outlook. I think like it's a creative outlook, which is that you should be creating something.
Yeah.
If it and quite and probably that should begin with yourself being, I hope, a better person.
Yeah, certainly.
And as you said, a more loving person, and loving better.
Yeah, I think he's still figuring it out.
But he's loving you better?
I think he, well, at the moment, I think he's struggling with some health kind of ailments. But, yeah, I mean, I guess he's figured out how to love his children better as a whole. I have two, well, I have three, I have two half-sisters and a half-brother from his first marriage. And they have told me stories now, as we've gotten older, where I've like I could recognize how much different he was before he had me, and I got so I was so lucky to have been in a household with him at a much more mature phase of his life, where I think he was more prepared to be a father. I think he had kids early and didn't know how to be. I think his first marriage really fell apart because of. Because of his inability to be selfless and give, I think he wasn't ready for it all. That's what it sounds like anyway in the stories I've heard. But he's, you know, people make mistakes along the path and there's nothing you can really do after something like that has happened besides apologize and move forward and try to change the action, like the way that you...
And he's done that?
I think a lot of change has occurred.
That's great.
But I think, you know, I think it's something that people also struggle with is like the, you know, it's left an impact and some people don't forgive themselves for certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that that's the case in him, but I feel like, you know, I know that I'm hard on myself and when I make mistakes, sometimes I have a lot of trouble, you know, giving myself, apologizing to myself and allowing that to be accepted. Does that make sense?
Of course it does. Of course it does. That's the hardest person to forgive. I can't project it to the entire world, but certainly for me and for most people I would say that I know or I've had any kind of deep discussion with, of course, the hardest person to forgive is yourself.
Yeah.
Because especially I think if you're driven.
Yeah.
And if you're driven and if you're searching for that thing that you talked about, you're going to be tougher on yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like. I guess maybe some people aren't. I don't know what it's like to not be that. So I guess I just project that to everyone. Oh, everyone must be like me.
Yeah.
Sort of a psychotic perfectionist who just like drives and drives and drives and comes up with things and, you know, and always just the self-flagellation, you know.
Yeah,
that was not creative enough, or that wasn't good enough, or you made that mistake again, or whatever. How stupid can you possibly be?
Yeah,
as opposed to really cutting yourself a break. Just go, man, let the guy up. And the guy is you.
Yeah.
You know, cut yourself a break.
And I think it's valuable for, I think youth are often the toughest on themselves.
Of course, they are.
Because they have these grand, they don't know yet whether they can achieve these grand things, but they have all these hopes in the world, and they want to achieve, you know, they see the progression of things often. And if something doesn't go right, they can be really tough on themselves if they didn't get the right SAT scores, or if they're, you know, depending on what their hope or dream is.
Right.
You know, if they don't see one of those steps in the process happening,
right,
they can say, oh, fuck, why?
And to aspire is, of course, a great right. thing.
Yeah.
But it's also, there's plenty of cultural poisoning in us that has to, we have to win, big, and we have to win fast.
Mm-hmm.
And just being creative and expressing something of ourselves from deep within ourselves isn't really quite enough. Everyone has to both love it a lot, and pay us a lot of money for it, or it's some kind of failure.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the hardest part, I think, of success is this, cultural acceptance that you don't have any control over it. When really, fundamentally, success is doing something that is fulfilling and makes you happy, finding your home in this world, your purpose. And that doesn't have anything to do with anybody else's eyes or ears or opinions. Or what they think of you as successful, whether they think you're successful or not. It's really inside the individual.
Absolutely, yeah. Was your mom successful?
And love, I think, has a lot to do with it.
Love has, well, knowing, nearly everything to do with it.
Yeah.
I mean, throw pretty much.
Knowing how to love.
Throw everything else in the trash, and it's knowing how to love and accepting love. And I mean, it's.
And loving yourself. For
and
sure.
loving yourself. All that stuff. I mean, that's all the important stuff.
Yeah.
And everything else is just, you know, funny faces.
Yeah. wait, what were you asking?
Was mom a success, or is mom a success?
She's been working in as an actress for 30 years and had a successful business for a while that she sold a few years ago. And I don't think, I mean, if we're really getting into it, I don't know that she would see herself as much of a success as I see her as.
Uh-huh.
Which I think is.
But isn't that true of artists, though? I mean, we go back, we go full circle here, but boy, that's true of artists.
But I think it's also, like, I think I've learned, I've also been lucky that I had a traditional form of success at a young age, and I feel like you did as well, at least having that acceptance of the people around you and being a part of something that was widely appreciated. But I've learned how to appreciate whatever it is that I'm doing. And how to accept myself and feel good about myself no matter what else is going on in my life. But so I got really lucky because my parents became Buddhist a year before I was born. And so I had the fortune of having that kind of fundamental upbringing where what I was learning, whether I was really invested in all of those Buddhist meetings or not, what I was surrounded by were these very optimistic, wonderful ideals that were instilled in me at a very young age. And so whether I still practice Buddhism or not, this is a huge part of my life.
Clearly from us working together, you were acting, you were working professionally at a young age, but were you like a tiny kid actor?
No. I mean,
like when did it start that you, well, what am I trying to say? Did mom start just bringing you out to auditions and it just seemed kind of organic and Martin just kind of read some pages and, well, yeah, sure, if you want to try it? Or did you say, hey, I see that thing that you do and I would like to try doing that?
She gave me a little shove. It was more to – it felt – you know, it feels like – you know, and not to say it was the wrong decision, but it feels like when I was younger – it was her pushing me into it in the same way a parent would push their kid into piano lessons or sports.
Baseball,
or,
sure.
Yeah. You need interests, and at first you don't know that these are valid options in the ways to spend your time. But this was specifically the one thing that she would kind of push. And And there were a few times where it got in the way, where I didn't get to go to a friend's birthday party or something, or get to do something because I was auditioning, or there was something else that was important to this career that I was building at 7 or 8 or 9. But nothing really panned out at that point. And then when I was...
Well, you weren't booking, like, whatever, Gum commercial, or whatever.
Well, I mean, I did a few commercials. I did a McDonald's commercial, which you can find on YouTube.
Really?
That has nothing. I don't think anybody knows that it's me. Well, I mean, not that anybody would care, I suppose, but it's not in the link. It just says, if you look up McDonald's diary commercial, somebody found it, and they were like, is this you? And I was like, oh, my God. That's so old. I think I was like 7, and I'm like reading this diary, my sister's diary, and she's in love with the hot guy who goes to McDonald's to hang out. It's so silly. And then I did like a Bank of America commercial, a few commercials, and then I don't know. Then I found at like 11, I started taking this improv class, and with a really great teacher named Kevin McDermott at this place called Center Stage LA, which I think is now not in existence. In any case, he's not a part of it anymore. He sold the company. But that's when I was like, oh, man, I can make people laugh. And I'm having a really great time doing it. And we also did, like, improv drama, and, like, it really exercised all these muscles that I was like, oh, I'm, like, building these muscles. These are, like, this is just so much fun to do these exercises that don't feel like exercises.
So it was never like a like sort of a classical acting class that we would all think of. It was an improv theater.
It was. The majority of it was improv theater. I remember some of the exercises being like standing in a room and like turning the lights off, and there was still like there was still like sun coming in through the window, but for the most part it was very dark in there, and you just kind of like find something physical about a character. Just try a new physical trait in the way that you're walking around the room and the way that you're moving, and just like interesting things that made me think differently than I would have about all of these things. Acting to me was just this extracurricular activity that I had to do because
mom gives you these lines that you're supposed to go, wow, that hamburger's great, and you're just supposed to do it in a convincing way.
Yeah, kind of. It always came very natural to me because she had a business that revolved around acting. So I would go in. And
was she in training or something?
She started this business, I think, the year I was born or a year before I was born or a year after. Somewhere around me being born, she started this business called In the Act, which was bringing in producers and casting directors and bringing people in to give scenes and give help to people in the way that they audition.
Uh-huh.
And then also just like doing a lot of where you only have the sides for a short period of time.
Cold readings?
Cold readings. So she did a lot of cold reading workshops. And so I would always go in there and have like 5 minutes with it. And I was the most natural of everybody because I was – my brain was just a sponge. I was just like, yeah, I can take this information. Let's go. I'm ready. And everybody else was like, I can't remember my lines. And that's how I feel now. And then I was just like, who cares? Like, this is the fun part of my day. I had to go to school earlier. You guys are so lucky. This is the hard part of your day?
So you were the best because you were playing.
Yeah, because it was
and everyone else was sort of working.
They were super serious. There was always that. There was a lot of, like, bitter people in their, like, 30s, 40s, 50s. There were also a lot of really sweet people, but I felt like there were certainly like the people that stood out to me because I couldn't relate to them. So I was like, that's weird. Like this doesn't – they weren't happy.
So in a kind of a showcase or a cold reading, it would probably be that person in their 40s that really hadn't worked very much and was getting a little bit testy and a little bit desperate that this path that they're on wasn't really working out in the way that they had imagined it would.
Yeah.
So you ran into them. So they're kind of with gritted teeth trying to take out their toolbox and work something into this scene where it would be successful. And you're showing up, what, 11 at that point?
That started as early as like 6, 7. Like once I could read, I was up there
And you're just playing games. You're just going up and reading the stuff and making a scene out of it.
Yeah.
And it
just
was working.
Just having fun. Yeah, and I think those people wouldn't. They would complain if I was in a scene with them because I would take the limelight, I think they thought.
Uh-huh.
So I would only go up with certain people, like one of my mom's like business associates. This guy like Bob Rumnock or other people that she was close with because they would love, you know, I'd spend time with them all the time. But it was fun. Like, I think that's what made it so easy. And then hitting that class at 11, they focused on cold readings and in general, like written scenes a little bit, but the majority of it was like getting up and improvising. And it was just, it was incredible.
So after the commercials and stuff, did you start doing that guest guy on Square Pegs?
Or
you never did that kind of stuff?
I never booked any jobs like that when I was younger.
Try and just never worked out?
Yeah, I think I was auditioning for a lot. I mean, I knew I was auditioning a lot, and I assume it was for guest star stuff and all that kind of stuff. But it just never was right. And probably for the best, because I think at that point my idea of a career was that movie Blank Check. You probably didn't watch it because you weren't in the demographic, but I was like 12 or 13 when this movie came out, and as this kid he gets hit by a bad guy. I don't remember what the bad guy did, but he was just like a bad dude who was trying to launder money through the bank, and he was leaving the bank in his really nice, fancy Jaguar, hits this kid on his bicycle. Bicycle's ruined. The guy writes him a check, signs it, leaves it blank. He's like, how much is your bike worth? And he's like, I don't. And he's just like, here, like, get yourself a new bike. Gives him a blank check. And him and his buds sit down in front of the computer, which is a new idea. They print the numbers, 1 million, goes to the bank, and gets $1 million. And the bank, who's like the dude that's running the bank, is like a bad dude because he's laundering money for this evil guy. And so he's like, oh, this is the guy that's supposed to pick up the $1 million. So he like gets this bag of laundered money now and walks out with it, like buys a house. And like, I was like, oh, that's what it's like to be an actor. Like you get a movie. Yeah. And then you just get a ton of like, you just get whatever you want.
You get a bag of $1 million and you just go buy stuff.
But he lived in a castle. Like, I was like, oh, that's crazy. So it's good that like by the time I actually did start working, my ideal of what the world was and what acting was had evolved.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Well, what kind, I mean, you were relatively young when Freaks and Geeks happened. So did you do stuff before that or did you just come to audition for that?
I just came to audition for that.
You came to audition for that. That was right. And you just, man, that I'm just struck with how perfect it was then.
Mm-hmm.
That a person with your background, your improvisational background, mm-hmm. your freedom to just be in scenes really, really organically,
yeah.
just really play, and then you come to Judd and Paul Feig and Judd Apatow, for people who don't know, these guys creating Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
And man, it fit like a glove.
Yeah. Yeah, it just all worked out.
Because, I mean, I know – well, tell me about auditioning for it. Can you?
Yeah.
I mean, was it a long process?
I auditioned for Sam and then Allison Jones asked me to audition for Bill. And then she was like, great. Come back. And, like, you know, she seemed pretty happy with it. And I was like, oh, okay, this seems sincere. And – I left, but I've been through so many auditions. Like, it didn't...
Right.
People seem nice enough. But she has a very particular quality of sincerity. She's such a fucking fantastic human being. And then I did a podcast... podcast, what am I talking about? Then I auditioned again, I think, for Paul or Judd. No, yeah, then I came back in for Paul and Judd. And it was right after I'd gone, I'd just gotten off school, and all I was thinking about was hanging out with my buddy Kenny Tarantino, who was with me at the time.
Who wouldn't want to hang out with Kenny?
Yeah, and no relation to Quentin. And And we were just having fun. I was like, oh, man, I don't even want to do this audition. Like, so I just went in and I did it and left. And I think that's what's on the DVDs. Was just like me just going in. I just wanted to be done with it.
I just so, almost blowing it off.
Yeah, well, it didn't. I was still nervous to go in, but I was like, I just want to go hang out with Kenny. And so then we went and hung out for the rest of that day. And then I went in for, the test, and they were really nice. And the way the part was written in the initial script was a short, round kid, a hefty fella. And I was tall and skinny, and so it didn't make sense that, like, I was like, oh, okay, they brought in, like, how they wrote it. I was like, okay, I'm not going to get this. It's great how nice they are and everything, but I'm not going to get this. And then we all got cast, and it, like, worked out so beautifully. It seemed, like, perfectly. I think they got all the people that they wanted for each part that they.
I think they really did to an incredible degree. Because
yeah.
I was
but that's
struck.
So rare. That alone is so rare that they, like, actually got the cast that they wanted. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, how often they have to put together three or four people just because the network is
the
like,
network is
we
saying
are going to tell you
right.
who you put in your show.
Exactly.
Even though you're the creative people who wrote this and envisioned it, we're going to tell you what you need.
Yeah.
And it's like they were just so lucky that they had.
Yeah, for people who don't understand the audition process, it's for you to say they got the people that they wanted for the show.
It's crazy.
It's crazy rare. It
Unless
just doesn't
it's an
happen.
Independent film, there's no way that you actually have any control.
Right. The producers of the show. Yeah, like you said, the people creating and producing this show have the dream cast, and the network will say, well, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, sorry, bud.
We don't want – no. The kid has glasses, and it's just no way.
It's literally like he's not handsome enough is what they're thinking.
Well, right. We can't sell him on another show or some, you know, we can't make him into a game show host.
Yeah.
But I was struck. It's going to sound like I'm kissing up to you on my podcast. I was really struck by you because, you know, I get cast as a coach on Freaks and Geeks. Not a big thing, but do you remember that we would get together to improvise?
Mm-hmm.
Improvise scenes that were in upcoming scripts, mm-hmm. and they were videotaping it and everything. Mm-hmm. It was these kind of free-form afternoons up at Judd's office,
mm-hmm.
or wherever it was. It was kind of a rehearsal hall thing.
Yeah, I think specifically for that episode where you were coming in as my father, kind of, where you're stepping into my world.
But, I mean, early on, I was struck most just by your improvisational ability, by your ability to just be in the scene and be completely natural in the scene and just go with it. Because to me, even then, that was unheard of for adults to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of live in the character and just let's just be at the dining room table. And just talk about this.
We had it at that point. Like, at that point, I felt like I had an understanding of what that character was. So, I don't even know where that came from, really. Like,
Where your understanding of the character came from?
Yeah, like, who that was. Because there had to be some association to people in my world at that point in time.
But I think your understanding of it, and I think your playing of it, again, it's going to... I mean, I really think it was the linchpin of the show. I think that in my opinion, I think Bill is the core of the show.
Mm.
I know it's supposed to be Sam, and it was Sam because Sam's got a lot of stories.
Yeah.
But I think Bill's, you know, that kind of quiet introspection, the ability to just be in his own skin, and whether in the scene, whether he was uncomfortable or at home more comfortable. I mean, I don't know. It was just kind of. The quiet got to me.
Mm-hmm.
Your ability to sit in a scene, not saying anything, but being so, I don't even know what I'm saying, so in character, mm-hmm. so in the scene.
Present.
So present there. Yeah. Because as you know, look, we certainly had a script, but we went off in the back of the car in that scene. We went off. In the scene where you were describing the characters in Dallas to me, where mm-hmm. we're both watching TV, they just kept the camera rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of went and went and went and went. And it was just comfortable.
Yeah.
And it plays. It just plays. And they put it in the show. Mm-hmm. You know, it was that often, as you know, those scenes where you think it really, something really real happened, something present, as you said, happened. I always think, oh, what a shame that's not going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a little too quiet, a little too natural. It's just, it's not going to live.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and it did.
Which that was the tone that they were going for, which is a rare. I think Judd is very good at that, finding that specific tone. I think he did it again with Knocked Up, like found a very natural tone. I think he did that with, he has a very good sense of what that is. And Paul was the seed for him. Like he saw this quality in Paul and just like watered it and made it work. And Judd has such a good sense of taste, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul had such an incredible talent for these stories and creating these stories and making these come to life. And this, and I mean, it was a beautiful marriage between the two of them, but you know,
but it takes quite an eye to just let something play like that. Quite an ear to allow quiet to happen.
Yeah.
I just not think somebody's got to talk. Somebody's got to say something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. I feel like I've now maybe been trained a little differently over the years. Because there is especially in comedy, there's so much more of a severe desire. I don't know if desires, but like almost pressure to continue the laughter. So if there's silence, that's bad. And your silence is where it begins. Like if you just keep talking, like a lot of people on stage, you just see they'll just keep talking. But silence is so powerful in both comedy and drama.
Absolutely. Well, it's the basis really of everything that's happening, in my opinion, mm-hmm. because it's flat out, it's just making everything real.
Mm-hmm.
It's giving the audience the ability just to you know, the willing suspension of disbelief for people to say, wow, this kind of feels like how I live,
mm-hmm.
like real people,
mm-hmm.
and allow something to happen as opposed to I talk, you talk,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a joke and then somebody talks.
Yeah, I'm totally with it. The beautiful thing about the show anyways is that there was, I mean, I feel like there was some improvisation, and we certainly improvised a lot, and a lot of scenes were improvised before they were written, or certainly more difficult ones. I do recall going into Judd's office, and know that a lot of the other cast did as well. But the writers were so severely in tune with what all the characters were and what all the actors were capable of, and could write so beautifully mm-hmm. to those voices.
Yeah.
So as much as I would love to take credit for all of the work that I put into it, the foundation and the beautiful paints that I was given to use on that show were all created by the writers. I was very lucky to be able to bring that character to life.
Mm. This is apropos of not very much, but not to cast all other producers other than Judd and Paul under the bus. I was doing something about a year ago, uh-huh. and it's a little scene, it's a little monologue where I'm talking about my son. And as you know, as you do, as I do, it was a little bit lengthy because I was taking time uh-huh. to deliver it, to speak from the heart, to make it real.
Uh-huh.
And the director and the producer came up to say, you know, to communicate to me how much they like that, but then, you know, the network will never let them have that on the TV show. It's like they're yeah. saying, like, we get how great that was. And we I love it. I love it. I feel horrible. Could you do one faster? That's mm-hmm. that's where you're just getting to those beats and stuff. And I know I like the other one better. I know. But just somebody's going to tell me, like, that takes too long. Get out of this scene. So you just have to say the things. And I believe in my son this and that way and this way and that way. Nothing kind of occurs to me as I'm talking about him. I have a pre-planned speech about saying things about my son.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you have to do it because they're paying you money. So you're like, well.
I've done some silly things. I've told, I've not done things that I've been asked to do sometimes. And I just realized, like, there are some jobs that I don't, that's helped me learn that I don't need or want to take some jobs.
I think that's fantastic. And I'm not.
I mean, I think it was a mistake. When I look back on it, I should have just done it. I agreed to do this. And, you know, no matter what the circumstances that led to it, I said yes.
Honestly, I disagree with you. In a way. I do my stuff because I have four kids and I have you know, school tuitions. And I've seen people get fired off sets. Yeah. I've seen it, you know, plenty of times. It really happens.
Yeah.
Even if you have an argument, you say, I really feel very strongly.
Well, I said no.
Yeah.
They were like, I want you to do this while I was on camera in front of the crew and everybody. And I said, no, I'm not going to say that. Doesn't make sense. Those words don't make sense.
I like it.
And they, and then she, like, she was like, she told me to say it again, and we had talked about it before the take.
Yeah.
She was just calling me out in front of everyone.
Right.
I was like, no, this isn't, you know, I'm not going to be bullied right now. And then we talked about it after that, and she was like, listen, I understand that you're standing up for something, but I just want to talk to you about this. And there came a point where I was like, fine, I'll just say it. Like, what am I doing? And she was like, the director was like, no, this, I mean, I think it's good that you were standing up for this. I have to represent these other people.
Of course.
And so, like, I think what you were doing was good. And if this is what you believe, then do it. At this point, we're past it. You don't have to do it anymore. We've already, you've gone over the hump.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to make you do it at this point because they understand that you're just going to say no again.
Right.
So don't say yes now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, okay.
I applaud it, Martin. I do. I mean, look.
It was a hard to say. It was an incredibly hard thing to.
I don't know how many acting classes I was in where this issue comes up. Hey, should I do the thing that's against what my heart is telling me to do?
Yeah.
And the acting teachers almost always have said, hey, man, how badly do you need the money? You know? Or whatever. Do you want to be in it? I mean, are you making money for this or whatever?
Yeah.
Are you behind in your rent? Then do it. Are you? Do you need something? Then do it. If you're not, if you're okay, then yeah. I mean, everyone. I would assume that carpenters have those decisions too, to take a job or do something that you have to do or not do.
I wonder. It's a bit of a different world because you're while it is creative. Well, I don't know. I mean, we were just getting specifically into carpentry. I feel like there's – it depends. It depends what the creative outlet is.
I suppose.
It's like paint – it's like – I think it's similar to the Disney. Like whether you want to paint
Johnny Depp pirate paintings or not. Right. Right. So we all have a line, and I've certainly done that sort of stuff. I go, no, I'm not – that's not me.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that. I mean, good luck with the guy you get.
Yeah.
But that's – I'm not doing that.
It's not – if you know it's not going to be fulfilling – I didn't know that that's how that was going to go.
Well, that's, as you know, that can happen on a set, mm-hmm. which is specifically designed to make you uncomfortable mm-hmm. for you to, in front of a rolling camera and everyone.
I had my shirt off.
Right.
It was like I was in a very vulnerable position in many ways,
yep.
not only just being in front of the camera, but I literally had my shirt off and like it was like so uncomfortable. I was like, I can't believe I'm – part of me was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. Why am I doing this? But I just felt so strongly. The words came out without me controlling them. I was like, no, this isn't going to happen. I'm not going to, and I'm especially not going to be bullied into it.
Right.
There's no way that you're going to overpower me and be a bully. That's not going to happen right now. If you want to talk about it, we'll talk about it. But you're not going to tell me in front of these people to pressure me into doing it what to do. And you know that I don't want to do it. It wasn't an innocent mistake. That's what would piss me off the most. Was like, and she's in another room.
Of course, it's by design.
She's in another room talking through a microphone, so a loudspeaker is coming into the room, and that's her direction. So everybody's hearing this. There's nothing quiet or. Oh, it was that was so aggravating. Part of the reason I took the job was because I thought my friend Ali Ashokat was going to be on the episode, and then she didn't do it, and I talked to her afterward, and I was like, oh, well, I'm going to go do this now. I've already said yes. And it was still, like, it was an interesting script, and it was an interesting show, and it was certainly a life lesson. And I didn't have a terrible time as a whole, although it was 112 the day that we worked in the valley, and it was just, like, brutal.
Yeah.
Thank God I got to take my shirt off. But,
you know. But that can certainly happen on set, and I'm glad you said that, and I'm glad you didn't do it. Because, because they'll say a lot of things for you to do. They'll make you jump through a lot of hoops.
Yeah, just learn. You learn what you're willing to do and not do. You just learn your own boundaries, really, as an artist.
Yeah. It's just coming into my head, but at the end of the movie Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall, and the director wanted to do close-up. There's an end scene where he's working in a garden. He's like hoeing, and it's talking about the loss of his daughter, and he's saying about his relationship with happiness. You know, he's saying, "I never trusted happiness. I never will," and that kind of a thing. And they were starting with close-ups. And Duvall was saying, I really think that this should be like a painting, like a wide shot with the land, with the house, with her sitting here, with me hoeing and having this scene. And the director said, we need to cover it. So let's start with close and we'll see, and we'll get the sun right or whatever. Anyway, Duvall said, well, let's just start it with the shot, with the wide shot. We'll do it, and we'll just see how it works, you know. So they do this wide shot. They get the house. They get everything. They get him hoeing and everything. And he says this whole speech to her, and happiness, never trusted it, never will. And cut. He leaves.
That's amazing.
He left. Just like, well, okay, let's set up for the two shot. No, Bobby's gone.
That's amazing.
So, you know, sometimes you, I guess, do what you have to do if you're a movie star.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't pulling rank or anything. It was just like, because it wasn't a decision. Like, maybe he'll think, oh, maybe that wasn't my place. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And perhaps that wasn't my place in the episode of that show that I did. And that's a strong argument for sure. But I made a judgment call, and my judgment of the situation and of that dialogue hasn't changed. Like, afterward, I never said, oh, it does make sense. I just didn't thoroughly investigate what these words meant or the grammar that was being used. No, I understood it, and it did not make sense the way it was written. I changed a slight thing, and it made sense, and they said, we want you to change it back. And I was like, I'm not going to. I made it make sense. This now makes sense. It wasn't funny not making sense. I'm utilizing the words at our disposal as Americans in the English language to make this make sense.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Like, at the going back to Freaks and Geeks, but the end of it, as because you weren't really experienced in it. TV series or whatever. No. What was going through your head as the series is kind of coming to a difficult close because it's always up against the World Series or whatever, and they're changing nights, and then you're in a show that seems to be in quicksand going down, and the New York Times is putting out stories, please don't take this show off the air, please keep it. What was going on?
It's amazing
on?
That three or four episodes in that it had that kind of following, that like people, the critics were like so invested in.
They were so invested.
I mean,
like,
Judd
this
must have done
is...
some good work, like getting these people, like giving them episodes in advance or something, and getting them invested in it.
Yeah,
to keep them.
Because that's what I at the time I was saying. Like, I've never been a part of anything like. Hey, man, I was in Back to the Future. I don't think, you know, I haven't seen the New York Times going, oh my God, this thing is unbelievable. Yeah. Don't take it off the air. This is what television should be like. Yeah. But, of course, it does go up against the World Series, and not enough people are watching it. And they just, you know, people want it to be the network just wants it to be watched by millions, remembered by no one, but watched by millions.
Yeah.
What was going through your head in this first TV – you know, you're kind of the star of a TV show. Were you liking being the star of a TV show?
I was having such a good time – living it. It was so much fun to go to work every day. It was such a good environment. Most of my memories involve smoking a lot of weed, which I started doing, I think, a little bit before then. So a lot of my off time was spent like...
Wow, you're a pretty young guy.
Hanging out with Seth and smoking weed. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had smoked weed before that, but that was like... It became very available at that point. And And then and a friend of mine left her apartment and moved in with her boyfriend or fiance or something, got engaged, I think. So I now had an apartment for a month while we were shooting that was a block away. And I put, like, a crappy futon couch or something in there. And, like, me and Seth and... because we didn't have a place outside of where our parents lived to hang out. So we would go there and hang out and, like, listen to the radio and smoke weed and hang out for, like, a month. And then I remember running away from teachers a lot.
Oh, you mean set teachers?
The set. Yeah. We had our set teacher who looked like a big lumberjack. The nicest guy in the world. But he was, like, this big lumberjack, like, bigger than you. And just like all muscle, and like he wore a lot of plaid and had a beard for a while. And he was such a nice guy. And I used to just run away from teachers. I hated school, the idea of school. And now I felt like I had some control over it. Like now they had to come get me. I didn't have to be in class. They had to come get me. So I was like, fuck it. I'm going to go have fun. And I didn't want to be in school, so I would just run away. And it was probably the best set environment. I'd say that and Party, the show that I did on Stars 4 or 5 years ago called Party Down. Those are the two best set environments I've ever been a part of. Just family, just very encouraging and really fostering growth in the people around you. It seemed like everybody was really trying to make what we were doing as good as it could be. And I think a lot of this business, unfortunately, is quite the contrary. Everybody wants to be better than everybody else. And it's okay if you suck and somebody has something to do with you sucking in order for them to look better. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
There's very little thought of the end result and ultimately that this is a collaboration. So you looking better on this podcast makes me look better.
I mean, that's
necessarily, but our, you know, that like that when you're creating something with somebody else, both of you being at your best is what's good. We're working together.
Right.
That's a rare, unfortunately, a very rare vibe on set is the togetherness.
Right. Because I have to win. The scene,
mm-hmm.
pardon me, including actors, as you know, who will go into a scene in order to specifically distract you.
Yeah.
In order specifically to do something that will throw you off your game. So yeah. I kind of win the scene and get more camera coverage.
Yeah.
Because that might, who knows, make me a movie star, get me a better TV show or whatever. Yeah. It fascinates me, but it's just, it's just true.
Yeah, that specifically is a trip. Even hearing about people who aren't present on other people's coverage for their off-camera stuff. Like,
gone, yeah.
It's one thing to have something to do. I mean, specifically have something important to do, and you have to be out on a specific day, but for that to be your MO of working, it's like, you're going to be in your trailer while we're shooting someone else's coverage, even though you're a big part of the scene,
right.
And your emotional, availability behind the camera could be of great value,
right?
In bringing the scene
for
to
people
life.
Who don't understand what Mart's talking about. It's, you know, we're in a scene and I'm the movie star and Martin is a character actor in the piece, and we're doing some, it doesn't matter how emotional a scene.
He's Tom's playing out an actual event that happened a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and, well, when we worked together in that movie you starred in, and I was, anyway, I did a little bit part of that.
Because I was the big movie star.
Yeah.
But, you know, it can happen that we're doing a scene and we do a two shot with both of us in the shot,
mm-hmm.
and then... then, of course, I'm the movie star, so we do my coverage where I get a close-up,
mm-hmm.
and I do all my emoting, and Martin is there doing the scene. We're still doing the scene.
Uh-huh.
And then when it's time to turn the camera onto Martin for his close-up, I split to have donuts.
Yeah.
And then the script supervisor, who is a lady or a man with a three-ring binder, and they have mm-hmm. the script on the binder.
Very
and Martin,
nice, very nice
very
person.
Nice person. very nice person.
Is now screaming the lines
right.
from
And Martin is saying, Dad, you never understood it. That was the thing about you. It was the 11th grade, and I wanted to play lacrosse. Gee, son, I try to be sorry, but I had so many things on my mind. Sorry, I guess, doesn't do it justice.
I'm amazed how well you remember the lines.
But that's what happens, I think we could admit, far more frequently than people would imagine.
I've never witnessed it.
You never have?
No.
Boy.
I don't work with people I don't want to work with. I feel like
that's
I've been really
good
lucky.
Stuff,
yeah.
Man.
I've been really. I also don't have a wife and kids to raise. That's because I see people my age. I'm now at an age where a lot of my friends are either married or getting married,
or starting that process
in
life.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so they're, you know, taking a job that's maybe a bit of a concession to what they really want in life. Is that the right word?
I'm not sure. I was going to. No, I don't think it's a. Maybe with some people it's a concession. Maybe some people think, well, I guess I'm 28. I guess you get married now and have a kid.
I suppose. I mean taking a specific job that isn't.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Then it's just yeah. absolutely, that happens to me and everybody, man.
Yeah, sure. So you take it because the money is good.
Sure,
because,
man, I just want to – I just need the health plan or yeah. I need – you know, I just need to be out there and I just need to buy groceries. So, hey, if you do whatever, some cop show.
Yeah.
But Lieutenant Johnson, we got the –
I totally
get it.
I mean, I totally understand that, like needing to do that for your family.
Yeah.
But I just feel lucky that like when I've made choices that I've – when I made choices that have turned out not to be the best, it's been with a pure heart of wanting to do it.
Right.
And then you find out, oh, okay, I learned something this time. That like I need to be more specific about the producers that I work with or about the director that I work with.
Yeah.
I need to investigate what this is and ask more questions usually is all it is. It's like when I'm on the phone with the director or when I'm auditioning for something that I like know what I'm auditioning for.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Know whether I'd be happy on it. Like, I don't tend to be satisfied by sitcom. Sitcom is a medium that I don't understand. It doesn't fulfill me, is ultimately what it is. That type of humor. I think it's a beautiful... I mean, there are some beautiful sitcoms in this world, but they don't feel like sitcoms. My favorites are, like, Roseanne was maybe the best sitcom of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Seinfeld is an amazing sitcom. It's a very different style. Stylistically, it's very different. But like Roseanne, I feel like I could have been on because it's real. It had the same breaths that you were talking about that Judd and Paul allowed and wanted and expected. And that's rare. That's really rare on TV in general, but especially on a sitcom.
Now you went off after you've done a. You know, I didn't IMDb you or anything. I don't know stuff, but you did a number of the Judd movies, didn't you? Or did you continue working with him in various things?
I mean, we stayed in contact. I worked on Knocked Up, and then
okay.
I don't know. I don't know what else.
What did you do? Because I saw you. I don't know what it was. We ran into each other,
mm-hmm.
and you were doing a very different look. You were doing a real. Kind of a punky look. You had the whole, like a hair thing going, and a whole.
When was that? A couple years ago?
No, this was quite a while ago. Oh. Was that from doing music? Do you think, or was that like a backlash doing a very different thing than you'd done before?
Oh, when I had a mohawk. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I didn't know that it was a total mohawk, but I remember. Wow, Martin is either. You know, doing a very extreme thing in a movie or TV show, or you know, he's decided, hey man, I'm just I'm changing things up for a while, and I'm doing a different thing.
That's what it was. I wasn't satisfied with what was happening in my life, and I think that was when I quit acting. I quit acting for a year
uh-huh.
because of the people that I had surrounded myself business wise.
Oh, like agent manager kind of stuff?
My agent was terrible. I only had an agent up until that point. Carrie Estrin was her name, and she was phenomenally bad for me.
Uh-huh.
And didn't in any way guide me. She just she just let me sit there on her shelf.
And she's looking for whatever, the next Bill Haverchuk kind of role or something?
I don't know. I don't think she was looking for anything. I spent a year or two with her where she didn't do anything, where the only jobs that I got were offers because of Freaks and Geeks.
Right, right.
And because of whatever, you know, had been put on display from that and people liking Judd's work or what have you. Even though the show hadn't been very widely received in Hollywood, people were somewhat aware of it. But so like I you know, went through a crazy phase. I got a mohawk, shaved my head for a bit too, and I was just like, I need a change in my life. And I guess that's where it started.
So you were okay financially. You were doing all right in order to say, I don't know what it is, but I'm doing a very different thing.
I was okay for a while, luckily, and then it all kind of. Are we doing all right on time?
You were doing okay. I just don't want to take up too much of your time because I think you're interesting.
Where were we?
The big change of being okay financially and okay and cool with yourself and just going, hey, I'm getting a mohawk and buying some new threads and doing a different thing for a while.
I was okay for a while. What inevitably happened was I ran out of money. I bought a condo. I bought a place to live due to my mother kind of helping point me in that direction. And I think she let me borrow some money at that point as well to put like extra down payment or something on it. And she wanted to make an investment. But I put, you know, I put the majority of my money into that place. And then I lived there for about a year until all of this kind of like came to a head. I was like, oh, shit, this isn't working out.
The mohawk guy.
No, I mean, I didn't keep it for that long. But, like, at some point in that year, I had a mohawk for a month and then shaved my head for a month and just kind of explored life in ways that I hadn't prior in an attempt to, like, find myself or something.
In what kind – I don't want, you know, all of them. And, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time, as I said. But in what ways did you find fruitful in doing a different finding different parts of yourself?
I didn't find anything fruitful, I think, specifically because my journey was attempting to fill a void. I felt lost after Freaks and Geeks had ended. That filled such a creative space in my life, and then it was gone, and here I was trying to use the skills that I had acquired on my path so far to like use them in this same realm, and it was impossible. They created such a beautiful stage. They set such a wonderful stage for us to play and to enjoy being artists. That I couldn't find that again. It's impossible. Until Party Down, I couldn't enjoy that at all. And it was totally different. It was in a completely different way, but they were very equal scenarios. And it was very unique to that. Like, as much as I think Judd, you know, does a good job at fostering comedy and fostering creativity, that set was very unique to everyone, including Judd and Paul, and perhaps the best environment for being an artist and being vulnerable that you could have ever asked for. There was such a great crew, and they were so sensitive because there were children on set. Like, I think everything about it was so... You never get that. As an adult, people are just like, oh, you must be calloused, and you must have been through a lot of shit. So people are just harder on you and don't expect that it requires much of you to be emotional in something. Like, there are times where, like, I've had to, you know, be emotional in a scene, and then it's just like, oh, turn it on, turn it off. And people are just like with you or taking jabs at you at like the quality of that scene. You're like, man, I'm still like, I got to do another take of this.
Exactly.
Don't start like nitpicking my, you're not even the director or something. Right. You're just, you know, I don't need the script supervisor telling me whether that performance was good enough. I know you're joking, but like, I got to go cry again in a second. So if you don't mind, maybe not being a dick right now, that'd be awesome.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's... So it's not the norm for people to... appreciate and be sensitive to your plight.
People don't appreciate it. No. I don't. Well, you know,
they oftentimes just think it's bullshit. It's like, oh, act, yeah, go acting. It's a rough life. And it's like, no, it's not a rough life. I never claimed it to be a rough life. I'm very fortunate to be where I am. But
right now, my job, yeah, my job demands that I take myself to a place that no one else on this entire set is.
Yeah.
Which is deep within myself,
yeah,
in a very personal way, mm-hmm, in order to share something intimate with the camera and with an audience.
Yeah, and that sounds a little hokey to some people, and I get it. But like, at least give me the respect to just shut the fuck up for 10 minutes.
Well, it sounds hokey, I guess, only if you're doing, you know, like a bad cop show.
Well,
if you're doing something that is genuine,
no, totally,
then you need that stuff. Then you need to be people to be a little quiet, and then you don't need the script supervisor coming up and going like, your tie was a little, you know, was a little this way. You have to tie it a little more. And when you say that thing,
I mean,
you have to get to the fire extinguisher by the time that you get there. And you okay.
That stuff I can deal with. It's literally like the insensitive remarks of, but. Maybe I'm just I'm holding on to things. Clearly, this is the best therapy session that I've had in a while. but it's not as easy a world once you get out of being 16 working on a set,
right?
Where people treat you with kid gloves, I guess.
Yeah.
But that was also, I mean, even for what that was, even with kids and everything, that set was perhaps the best set as far as I recall. Judd interviewed everyone on that set, like even the PAs and thing. Like, I think he was very sensitive about who he was bringing on to the show, and just made sure it was going to be a good environment. That's what I remember hearing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I never did my research to check and see if that was. I didn't investigate.
Yeah,
but that meant a lot to have done that kind of, because people don't. People don't really.
So the only real Freaks and Geeks backlash is that nothing compares to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost, the backlash.
Almost you know,
the backlash is, wow, this isn't quite as good an experience as when I was 16.
It couldn't be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to me that people still bring it up to me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, a major part of it or
you
whatever.
You were phenomenal on the show. I mean, there wasn't a weak link in the show. And I think part of that is the amazing talent that was brought onto the show in every regard, writing and acting, and Allison Jones doing her part, and Judd and Paul overseeing and making sure everything was great, and the gaffers and the cameraman and the DP Russ Alsobrook. Like, everyone was so invested, and even like the outlying people like Jake Kasdan, and everybody was so invested.
Now, you're doing music as well?
Yeah,
or you have been?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I follow you on Twitter and everything, and I try to keep track. Right. I try to keep track of what's going on.
Yeah, if I had known, I would have specifically invited you to come out. I mean, if you have any interest in coming, it's...
I would love to come sometime. I mean, what are you doing?
Performing again May 16th.
Is it a band that's you, or is it you, singer-songwriter kind of thing? What is it?
It's interesting. I grew up in Los Angeles, and my best friends growing up were all black, African-American kids, or Mexican kids, or like, you know, I grew up in a mixed community, and I didn't, besides like the, I mean, yeah, in every regard, Buddhist meetings, wherever I was, I'd say there were more white kids at the Buddhist meetings than there were at my schools. But I fell in love with hip hop music at a young age, and that evolved into me like writing terrible rap songs on my own, and writing stuff with Charlie Hunnam, Jason Siegel, Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, Baruchel, I don't remember how to say it. It's one of those ways. It's one of those that ought to be covered in there. And we used to write and produce our own rap songs that were just ludicrous. Just like, it was so much fun. But it was all just like,
shit, we were just shitting out of our mouths onto these microphones. And that was a blast. Everybody else kind of stopped doing it. And I was like, I like that stuff. I want to keep it. Like, that was, I felt at home there. So then I started doing poetry, like slam poetry type stuff, or just like open mic poetry in a style that felt like hip hop to me. And but it wasn't really slam poetry. Like, I think that's a very specific style that I don't necessarily embody. And then I found this guy, Jordan Katz, who plays the trumpet, and he was like, I saw him up on stage for an 826 LA show, and he was playing trumpet with this guy, Mark Evan Jackson, rapping random lyrics from all these different songs, just kind of collaging together all these amazing hip-hop songs into this like amazing collage of hip-hop music from my childhood. And I talked to him afterward, and we just started working together on music. And he started producing beats, and I started doing them. And he has a bluegrass band. And so it's a long way to answer your question, but eventually I've answered it now as I rap with a bluegrass band.
Excellent.
It's pretty ridiculous. It's a really fun show.
Where can people see? I mean, is it a regular gig that you have? Are you doing it around L.A.?
I think May 16th we're going to be – I mean, it's a little up in the air. But May 16th I think we're going to be playing at this venue called Central, The Central. It's in Santa Monica.
Uh-huh.
We've played there twice before. Last time we played there with this band called The Girls with Allison Brie and Daniel Hart. And Charlene Yee. It was fun. It's just fun. Do you play music?
I do. I play a lot of music, yeah.
Oh, really?
I play guitar. Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, if you need guitar and bluegrass,
I can do it. Do you have a band?
I don't have a band, no.
Do you play?
Occasionally I play with like backup instrumentalists and stuff, but it's not like – it's just me.
Do you sing?
I sing and play – yeah, and write songs and play.
Do you want to play? Do you want to do the show with us?
Sure.
Do you have any interest?
I'll do it anytime.
Great.
Anytime.
Done.
I'll do it. Hey, Martin, thanks for coming over.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're like one of my favorite guys. I've always been impressed with you, really, since, I mean, you were a kid on that show, and that was the real deal, you know, the real deal that you were doing, and I always respected it, and I've always been a fan, and I remain so.
Thank you.
I'm coming to your show, even if you don't give me the gig. I'm coming.
You know, you're going to be playing.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
I love Martin. I mean, I find him fascinating, and I found him fascinating when he was a kid. So when he's an adult with a beard now, hey, all the more fascinating just for facial hair. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for, consider subscribing or telling a friend about the podcast. Thanks to Emily Wilson. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars. Thank you for everything. But, you know, as always, hey, thanks to you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the feedback. Info at Tom Wilson USA or PO Box 18186, Encino, ENCIO, California 91416 USA. I appreciate it very much. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.